You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Quick note that the following episode of Canada Land may contain subject matter and language that some people will find offensive.
A note to listeners. Today's episode contains graphic descriptions of violence.
Crime pays, if you're a journalist. There is no beat more likely to get you an audience and a paycheck. Crime is trend-proof and recession-proof. Yes, true crime is freakishly popular right now, but it was never unpopular. Audiences have been showing up for gangster stories, and murder stories, and heist stories, and scam stories steadily for at least 100 years, probably a lot longer. It's big business. Which does not make crime reporting bad, necessarily. Crime writing can, in fact, be the very best kind of journalism. Meticulously reported, deeply humanizing, beautifully written, rising sometimes to the stature of great literature, like, say, with Truman Capote. But crime writing can also be the very worst kind of journalism. Parasitic, manipulative, exploitative, turning other people's misery and tragedy into a product owned by the journalist. Like, say, with Truman Capote. Michael Lista writes about crime. He writes other things too. Essays and poetry. But who reads poetry? People know Michael Lista because he writes about crime. For The New Yorker, The Atlantic, Slate, The Walrus, and Toronto Life. He's my guest today, and we're going to talk about what it means to live off of stories about the worst events in other people's lives. And our conversation is going to focus on one crime in particular, a crime that Michael writes about in his new book, The Human Scale. And that crime is the murder of Dr. Elena Frick. I asked Michael to briefly tell me the story of that crime. So before we begin, here's what happened.
Maybe we'll start at the end. On Friday, December 2nd, 2016, a suitcase was found by the side of the Humber River in Kleinburg, in Vaughan. And on the outside of it, it bore a little tag with the name of a town in Croatia. It happened to be the ancestral town of the Frick family. The suitcase belonged to Elena Frick, who was a beloved, well-respected family doctor. And inside the bag was Elena's body. She was wearing pajamas. Her hair had been cut off in ragged hacks. She was so unrecognizable, even though she had only been murdered less than 48 hours before. Her face was so unrecognizable that her mother, when asked to identify her, couldn't, and her father had to. Mohammed Shamji was Elena's husband. He was a neurosurgeon who specialized in spinal surgery, was really widely respected, grew up in a very well-respected family, sort of Ottawa gentry, and to the world it looked like they had this idyllic marriage. They sort of presented themselves on social media as this like fun-loving, jet-setting couple with three beautiful children. When the police and family and friends came to Mohammed to ask what had happened to her, he said, well, Elena had left in the night with her suitcase and her boyfriend. It turns out Elena had not left with her suitcase. She had left in her suitcase. It wasn't a whodunit for very long. It turns out she was in the process of leaving Mohammed. She had retained a divorce lawyer and had told friends that she'd been severely abused by Mohammed, not just recently in the months leading up to her decision to divorce him, but essentially as soon as they met in 2003. Mohammed had been abusive, controlling, and violent with her. 2 days after her body was found, police arrested then-Dr. Mohammed Shamji and charged him with her first-degree murder. It was her final attempt to leave him that brought him to kill her. He beat her to death and broke her neck in their home as their children sort of cowered and listened. 3 years later, he pled guilty to the second-degree murder of Elena Frick and is serving a life sentence with no chance of parole for 14 years.
Michael Lista joins me in our Toronto studio in a moment. A I've got a paragraph you wrote here. I want you to read it for us.
How the hell do people let us get away with it? We hover like vultures and call down like doves. We arrive as a kind of devilish apparition to the people who might be our sources, just as they're vanquished from their heaven. We're not their friends, their advocates, their pastors, or their shrinks. We're a ledger, a pen and a notebook, absorbing our subjects' anguish without fear or favor. Our job is simply to listen, to watch, to write, to file on time, and then to invoice.
Why the hell do they let us do it?
I don't know. On certain days, I'm still romantic about journalism, and I think it has, you know, a public utility. I think like many crime reporters over the past few years, I've sort of questioned whether or not it's really good for anything, especially as the genre sort of exploded in popularity. To me, it still matters to tell human stories humanely. I think there's just a sort of ontological good to it.
But that's not why they let us do it. That's not why the victims of crime talk to us.
No.
It's not for the greater good of humanity.
No. You know, when you encounter a source for the first time, it sort of will go either one or two ways. Either, very understandably, they'll say, you know, I'm not ready to talk about this, about the worst thing that's happened to me and my family. But there's another sort of group of sources who really do want to be heard, who want to tell their story because people aren't listening or they feel like they've been misunderstood, misrepresented by another reporter. They want someone to listen and to listen carefully.
Do you think that they let us do it because they do think that we are their advocates or because they do think that we are their therapist or that we're going to give them a voice and tell their story and they want, we are the mechanism through which they're going to get their version of it out. And if they think that, do we let them think that even though it's not true?
I've thought a lot about this. This is a hard question. You know, what I try and do when I first speak to a source is kind of explain sort of who we are, you know? And I say, listen, everyone does this job differently. There are some reporters who do think that they are a kind of advocate, if not for the source themselves or the story the source is telling, for some of the sort of socio-political concerns that the source and or their story represent. I let them know right up front that I'm not that kind of reporter, that I want to manage their expectations and let them know that I don't think that my work can really change anything. Even when it has sort of changed something, changed policy or changed law, I'm kind of surprised by it. You know, I want to manage their expectations and let them know that the only thing I can really do is to tell their story faithfully. And I find sources really do respond to that because a lot of the people I'm dealing with are not professionals. They're not seasoned PR pros, they're not politicians. They're regular people who have been sort of thrust into our profession's spotlight because something really horrible happened to them. So sometimes they're not even super sort of news media literate. And so I feel like I have a responsibility to sort of midwife them through the process, manage their expectations, and promise only to tell the truth as they see it.
I won't put this on you. I guess I'll just speak for myself. Mm-hmm. I try to also be very clear what the terms are, who I am and who I'm not, what they should expect. And, you know, what you find, as with any source, not just crime stories, is that people really do need that explanation and people really don't understand how we do our jobs or the differences between being on the record or on background or what you use and what you don't. And the fact that you are going to be getting the other side of the story and you are going to be telling other people that you were told this, what do you have to say about this? I give an expansive explanation of my process. And often I feel like one of those long terms of use forms that people agree to without reading because they are there to have a story written or broadcast about them. And at that stage of the game, they're just, sounds good to me. And then what often happens is I enter into a relationship in which they do come to talk to me like I am a friend or a therapist or an advocate. And then the story comes out and sometimes it's not what they expected and they feel terribly betrayed.
I've had the same thing happen to me more than once. I think that the people who do want to tell their stories, they do often enthusiastically. People love to be heard. Almost no one likes to be written about. even if it's done sort of overweeningly flatteringly, they still find something to be sort of upset about.
It's so disempowering for somebody else to tell your story.
Absolutely.
Even if they're glorifying you.
Exactly. Exactly. Even if it's done well, with respect, and even often if it's flattering, there will be something like, well, no, you got this wrong. I told you it was this way and not that way. When you were mentioning sort of the, you know, despite the disclaimer, you find yourself often in a relationship where the source can treat you like a friend or like you're their advocate.
And therapist. Late night calls, working through emotional issues, especially people who are victims.
Yeah, I find the same thing. And I allow myself to be available when I'm doing one of these stories pretty much day or night, you know.
Night is when sometimes you get the best quotes.
That's it. I know. When you see that 11:30 phone call come through, you're like, this could be very good.
Back to your reference to vultures.
I know. But at the same time, I have three things to which I'm beholden. The source, something like the truth, but then also my readers, right? Like I kind of think that, you know, as a journalist, your audience is in many ways your first obligation because you're just sort of like a pane of glass between the truth that's out there, the people who are trying to tell it, and your audience. You know, I think one of the ways in which we get the really good stuff is by creating that intimacy, which is inevitable, right? Is it vampiric? Is it disingenuous? No, because I think that in many ways, even though you're not their friend or their therapist or their advocate or their priest or their lawyer, whatever, you know, two people talking about one of the most intimate, horrible things that can happen to someone, I think it has to involve something like care on the journalist's behalf. We like to think of ourselves as objective, dispassionate, but I think that when any journalism, especially crime journalism, is done well, it's because the journalist does end up caring. That doesn't mean that you are out to fix the source, to solve their problems, to clean their conscience, any of that stuff, but you do have to care about the fact that a very human thing has happened to someone, which is steeped in the most profound emotions people can feel. And if you're not feeling it as a journalist, I don't think you're doing your job right.
Yeah, no, I do. I think you have to care. I mean, you have to care for your reader to care.
Right.
But caring, you know, when you say you're beholden, it's an interesting phrase. And I think, you know, especially when you're dealing with victims, like you do owe them something and you owe them something beyond just that you're telling their story, you're telling the truth. You know, I think that you owe them a certain like duty of care. Mm-hmm. And yet, to be beholden to them and the truth is sort of like, I'm not sure that those are put on an equal level because, I mean, one thing that I've learned is that every story that anybody casually tells you does not survive fact checking. Any story that people have been telling within a family for generations is riddled with four things have been turned into one thing or something's been exaggerated. And so without calling anyone a liar, you can hear from a victim and they are telling you the most intimate things and you care about them and then you go and you verify and at best there'll be some modification and sometimes you'll catch them in something.
Yeah.
And if you are given a choice between being beholden to the truth and being beholden to the source,
gotta side with the truth.
Yeah. I think to make this specific, we're going to focus on one story that you've reported.
Sure.
And that is the murder of Dr. Elena Frick by her husband, Mohammed Shamji. Let me ask you to read something that you wrote about your reporting of that story.
After her slaying, her friends, family, and colleagues bemoaned on social media that press coverage was framing the story as, quote, brilliant neurosurgeon murders wife. By sliding into the narrative grooves a criminal lays down for the writer, the newspaper reporters made those grieving Frick feel like she was a secondary character in the story of her own demise. So I started reaching out to them with the promise that I'd do a different kind of story, one that centers the victim, makes her the main character, and foregrounds her life, mind, and decisions.
I have been dubious about this notion of victim-centered crime reporting. At its worst, it has felt to me like a very specific and specifically biased form of biography where we're not going to glorify the killer or give them the attention they deserve, even if it's infamy. No, we're going to valorize the victim. And it's a biography that's written differently than any other biography. And a writer writing a biography is looking for conflict, is looking for a complicated character. But at its worst, this kind of writing, victim-centered crime reporting, is lionizing. It's a hagiography where, mm-hmm. and the only reason you're writing this glowing biography is because it ends with them getting murdered.
Mm-hmm.
And they've sort of earned this very positive write-up of their life because they happen to get murdered.
Mm-hmm.
It's always seemed like a strange exercise that's only being done in opposition to what people actually want to read.
Yeah.
I don't think you did that with this story. I think you succeeded in telling the story, not really just the story of the deceased, of the victim, of Dr. Alana Frick, but really it's the story of this relationship.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate that. And, you know, as I write in the postscript to the story, where I kind of talk about the process of reporting and the narrative gambit of it all, you know, I too, as I started reporting the piece and then writing it, I too was a little bit dubious of it. You know, I'm critical in the book about examples of other crime writers who have done it. And in fact, even of the judge in the Alec Manassian case said a similar thing in her judgment. She refused to name Manassian. Instead, she called him John Doe because mm-hmm. she said it was his own haywire imaginings of fame that sort of led him to do what he did.
Alec Manassian, of course, the self-described incel who in 2018 drove a van onto the sidewalk in Toronto, killing 11 people.
And I disagree with the premise in many ways because, you know, having a crime story without a villain that, as you say, sort of makes a hagiography of the deceased is kind of like trying to remake meteorology without talking about the storms.
Why are we pretending that this is anything other than it is?
Of course. Of course. What I wanted instead, and I appreciate you saying that you didn't think I screwed it up too badly, was that I wanted to understand their marriage. Shamji wouldn't talk to us. But I wanted to understand Elena's mind, the decisions that she made and that were visited upon her from her perspective. And it's not because by being murdered, one turns into a saint or anything like that. It's more that, you know, I found this is in many ways the story of a marriage. And what I wanted to know was what were the dynamics that were happening inside the marriage and how Elena was allowed to be sort of isolated, how she was sort of removed from the other apparatuses of support that her friends and her family, the story she told about her marriage online, in public, and also to those closest to her, in order to sort of see how a horrifyingly abusive relationship like this, how it sort of operates. So it was more a way of trying to take a look under the hood of this, of a relationship, than it was sort of making a saint out of her.
You wrote that we write villains as main characters for a reason. They're the ones who make the consequential decisions.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually like, it's really hard to do what you did, because it's easy to write about crime when you are writing about the decisions. Like, you know, in any story,
right,
action is great, and somebody who takes action, and then if they're a criminal, it's just interesting.
Mm-hmm.
The criminal woke up. What did he do next?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how did, and you know well how it ends. It ends with them doing a terrible crime, so you're invested and interested immediately. Mm-hmm. So how do you do the other thing? How do you write about the victim? And we've kind of talked about the wrong way to do it, or kind of like, I think, a dull and maybe dishonest way to do it. The way you did it, it's more than the story of the relationship, and this is why I'm really focusing on it as a difficult thing to pull off, because it's really the story of how this was able to happen, and that's so close to, it's the story of her inaction in a lot of ways, and the danger of writing a story about why she didn't leave, which she ultimately was doing.
Mm-hmm.
Could very easily become a story of victim blaming.
That's what I was most scared of.
Yeah.
By trying the sort of narrative gambit where it's Elena who is the one who is making, we're seeing her decision-making process over and over. You know, it actually kept me up at night after the story came out, was I was really scared that by trying to sort of center her as the main character, you know, I was worried, number one, that it would be misunderstood as the sort of hagiography you're talking about. But then I was worried about the opposite. I was worried that by making her the main character, I was kind of implicating her as the engine of her own demise, right?
Right.
Which is it's the last thing anyone reporting on domestic violence, which in and of itself is very difficult to do. I was terrified of that.
On the cover of Toronto Life, a photo of the smiling couple, it's hard not to read a story like that as, here's the story of how she got murdered. You know, Chapter one, she was born.
Right.
Which does, I guess, suggest some level of like agency, or here's her role in this happening. But I think what you emerged with is something that did not overplay things in that direction. But there are little parts where the reader gets a hint of how she was failed in other ways. And, you know, you remind us that prior to him killing her, he was charged. There were three criminal charges against him in 2005, one of assault against Elena and two of uttering threats of bodily harm. But after those criminal charges, the couple reconciled. And, you know, Dr. Shamji, the celebrated neurosurgeon, he used his stature and his connections to get this all tossed as sort of like a little domestic squabble, you know, like why should this unfortunate event impede his ability to travel to the United States and to work there? And the charges were withdrawn and he entered into a peace bond and he agreed to 12 months probation. It was a bit of a slap on the wrist. That is a critical juncture where something different might have happened.
Absolutely. And it's hard not to be a little bit upset with the Crown in that moment. And my interest in crime reporting has always been not just in the sort of anecdotal fact of the crime itself, that you know, this person killed that person, isn't that strange and bad? It's really how these imperfect people sort of navigate and are navigated by the sort of larger systems in which they work, you know, socioeconomic, jurisprudential. So when we see the Crown being so close to avoiding sort of intervening before things go horribly wrong and it's too late, it takes the context of Elena's thinking about her own relationship in order to understand how the Crown failed her. And if we don't understand the way Elena thinks, we don't understand how the criminal justice system fails a woman in that moment.
Returning to your process and the relationships that you had to enter into to tell the story, I'm going to ask you to read again something that you wrote.
Sure. Joe and Anna and I would spend hours across weeks talking about Elena at the kitchen table. When we spoke about her early life, the miracle that she had been born at all, her precocious, prodigious girlhood, her resolve and her accomplishments, they would smile and laugh, as if the vital part of her were sequestered somewhere beyond what Shamji had done to her. They gave me the only copy of the book of poems she'd written as a girl in high school, showed me her painting of those lovers dancing, the woman's back to us, the man's face left undrawn. When they cried, I couldn't help but reach out and grab their hands. And on one of my last visits to their house, I walked into the kitchen, where the boy was deep in play, and Anna, in a kind but commanding tone, said to him, come and say hello to Uncle Michael. Uncle Michael, I can't unhear those words, can't unring that bell. And this is when I started having real trouble sleeping, once I had everything I needed. Not only did I worry I'd gotten too close to the story emotionally, but now I worried, as I sat down to write it, how to protect it and everyone who trusted me from legal chicanery. But I knew something that I hadn't dared report, that their eldest daughter had been the only witness to their mother's murder, and Shamji's conviction would turn on her testimony. I'd console myself that I'd immunized the Crown's case against my reporting because I hadn't spoken to that daughter or published the fact that I knew what she knew. But the fact that she was in Windsor prepared to send her father to prison for life deepened my insomnia.
Holy shit. Let's take that apart a little bit here.
Mm-hmm.
You found out that this poor little girl... How old was she at the time that this happened?
I think she was 13 or 14.
When she was 13 or 14, she listened to her father murder her mother.
Yeah.
And you got close enough with her grandparents and even siblings that one of her siblings called you Uncle Michael.
Mm-hmm.
But you intentionally did not interview her.
Yeah.
Because if you did... that could compromise the case against the murderer.
Yeah.
Typically, we are not supposed to involve ourselves with legal outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
We are supposed to seek out witnesses who have firsthand knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
If you're reporting on a murder, the firsthand witness of the murder, that's somebody that the journalist wants to talk to.
Yep.
You're going to get the best information possible from the witness.
Yep.
To even... concern yourself with the legal process
mm-hmm.
by the book would be to concern yourself with the outcome,
mm-hmm.
which we're not supposed to get involved with or care
mm-hmm.
about.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, we're human beings.
Yeah.
And the idea that in getting this great stuff for your story, And maybe you're in a better position than me. I think I would stumble through it. But how would you f*** up the court case by talking to this girl?
Well, let's say this. Let's say I interviewed her in the ideal way you want to interview someone like that, like a first-hand witness on the record. Let's say I did, right? And, you know, I write, their eldest daughter heard her mother screaming at around 2 o'clock in the morning, and then a thud, and then, you know, she walked through the door and saw her father on the other side of the bed, and she could tell her mother was there, blah, blah, blah. I describe the scene. Then what a defense attorney could do is, say, walk up to her on the witness stand, brandishing a copy of Toronto Life, and say, here in Toronto Life, sorry, what time was it when you, oh, sorry, was it 204 or 206? Sorry, where was your father standing? You testified 20 minutes ago that he was standing over here, but in the article right here, you say he was standing over there. So which, you know, you're getting your facts wrong. How can we believe anything you're saying, right? I mean, it's a classic sort of defense attorney tactic. I couldn't in good conscience, knowing that the daughter would have to be and was prepared to take the stand to send her father to prison. I call me a bad journalist, but I could not put that family, that young woman in that situation for the truth, for a little bit more accurate description of what happened that night. I wouldn't be able to live with myself. And I don't know if our reader's interest is served. I don't know if the gambit of it is worth it. If our readers know a little bit more before the case about the actual murder, a few more details, if it's worth the potential human suffering that getting those details would precipitate.
Yeah.
I mean, what do you know? What do you think, Jesse? Like, do you think is...
Oh, it's a clear... I mean, it's not a very difficult decision.
Right, right.
I don't mean to make it sound like it is.
Yeah.
If there was a question as to his guilt, mm-hmm. you know, at this point he had mm-hmm. pled guilty.
He hadn't pled by the time we came out with the story. So Elena was murdered on December 1st, 2016, and our story came out 4 months later. But okay. He didn't plead guilty until years later.
Right. I guess what I mean is, like, this was not the kind of crime reporting where you were trying to figure out who did it.
Right. Exactly.
You know, if that was the exercise, like we do this kind of like rough first draft of what official processes do later or what hopefully the police are doing, you know, this was not that kind of a crime story.
No.
I think you would have had a much more difficult decision if you're like, well, I don't want to speak to the witness to this murder mm-hmm. because if in fact it was her father mm-hmm. and ultimately there's this court process, then et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
I think that would have complicated it and you'd have a real like one for the journalism ethics class.
Right.
I think in this case, you know, you'd have to be a real son of a to pursue that interview.
I agree.
It is interesting as a good example of like when we have to just check ourselves and understand that there are more important things than the public's right to know. You know, in this case, the victim's right to justice was more important. And I, you know, and you're taking ownership of something, which is a big part of this too, which is like we have to live with ourselves.
Yeah.
You write about this too in a way that was really moving for me. I have in my, you know, photo roll as my kids grow up, weird little snippets interrupting the story of their childhoods. Mm-hmm. I don't cover stuff as intense as you, but I've covered some pretty serious crime from time to time. Mm-hmm. And then just a bunch of weird media stuff. And interspersed with, I guess, any reporter's memories of their own lives and their own children are screenshots and photos of people we cover, little bits of evidence, little things to remind ourselves. And if you don't have really good practices around putting those in different folders and getting them away, well, here's how you put it.
As I investigated the crime, her friends and family sent the pictures to me so I could better understand who she'd been, and an algorithm somewhere clocked their digital stamp and sent them back through time, filing them chronologically into the carousel of my own life, retroactively braiding her memories with mine between my day at the beach and my night at the bar. She and Shamji still appear in those montages set to music that the photo app puts together unbidden, shuffled into my hand like an errant pair of cards from a foreign deck, as if some computer program has an insight into what I can barely dare admit, that in some indelible way, our lives are forever stitched together.
So just to be clear about what happened, mm-hmm. you had on your phone a bunch of pictures of both the murderer and his victim, mm-hmm. like kind of like family pictures of them smiling, posing together, things that you had collected or had been sent to you.
Yep.
And that got mixed in with your own photos.
Yeah.
And then when, like, when the photo app does its little memories together, mm-hmm. we've created you a digital montage, yep. and they play a little canned music. You saw them mixed in with the people who you're closest to in your life.
I think it was called, I think the montage was called like Fun with Friends.
No, really?
It was something like that.
Oh my God.
And it was,